Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today we will look at how COVID-19 impacted Wyoming over the past year. Many say that health orders went too far and harmed many businesses, but others say the state health officer helped the state.
The survival rate that we've had of our hospitality businesses has frankly stunned me.
COVID-19 has brought public health employees into the spotlight, and they are getting burned out by the amount of work and verbal abuse.
I just could not talk to some of these people because they were out of control. A lot of us felt threatened.
And nonprofits across Wyoming have been impacted by COVID-19. Now it's time for them to move forward.
I'm terrified that not only the city and the county might forget, but the whole community.
It's all up next on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Since the start of the pandemic, some Wyoming residents and business owners have indicated that state officials, especially the governor and the state health officer, have had a heavy-handed approach to health orders. While many people and businesses did suffer financially during the pandemic, state officials say they did try to reduce those impacts. Just to be clear, the pandemic had a devastating financial impact on Wyoming. While numbers are still being sorted out, David Bullard, who's a senior economist with the Research and Planning section of the Wyoming Department of Workforce Services, says from March to April, over 24,000 jobs were lost.
I have not seen anything like that before in a 1 month that sharp of a contraction in employment.
Bullard says the losses were across all sectors.
The largest job losses were in leisure and hospitality, particularly restaurants and hotels. From there, retail trade. We saw job losses in local government, in healthcare, natural resources and mining.
On March 27th last year, a health order closed all restaurants, bars, theaters, gymnasiums, childcare, and all schools, including higher education. In mid-May, those facilities could open with restrictions.
You know, the pandemic has been disastrous for the hospitality and tourism industry.
Chris Brown is the executive director of the Wyoming Lodging and Restaurant Association. He says the COVID outbreak led to cancellations and losses that ranged from 10 to 50% for hospitality businesses all across the state. And that's even with federal help.
If it weren't for the relief programs, you know, that came down from the federal government, it would have been much worse. I mean, many more businesses would not have survived.
Nobody really knows how many businesses have actually closed due to the pandemic. And the other piece is nobody knows what impacts the health orders had. At the start of the pandemic, State Auditor Christy Racines headed up a task force that assessed the impacts COVID-19 was having on businesses in the state and what needed to be done to provide assistance. She says some businesses did close for good, but it's unclear what impacts COVID or health orders had on them.
The health orders certainly did things that reduced revenue and closed people down and limited customers. That being said, I think even after those were lifted, I think there were many businesses that just experienced such a drop in customers because many folks just weren't ready to come out, whether there was health orders or not.
When the legislature met this year, some lawmakers put the blame squarely on the state health officer for the state's economic difficulties through COVID and brought legislation to punish her and give more power to elected officials. Dr. Alexia Harris says her job is to protect the public health by controlling the spread of COVID-19. But Harris also contends that she really didn't do as much as her critics think.
And really, since early summer of 2020, no businesses have been closed, though we have asked for, again, those higher risk businesses to take certain precautions, usually distancing, sometimes mask use, to lower the risk of transmission in those environments.
Harris adds she also tried to keep things as normal as possible. open schools, the return of fall sports, and allowing some fans at UW football games were examples of this.
So our focus at the Department of Health, of course, is primarily the public health and how we can protect that. But we always tried to balance as much as we could all of the other concerns and take the minimum precautions and measures necessary to protect the public health.
Harris notes that the only time they did a statewide mask order was when COVID numbers exploded around Christmas and hospital space was limited. And while those on the outside think Harris and the governor were heavy-handed, that's not what those in the hospitality industry think. During the mask order, the hours bars could be open was reduced. But Mike Mosher of the Wyoming State Liquor Association says the governor limited that impact.
Things like enabling CARES Act money to assist for the period of time where we had to restrict hours of operations for bars, where they had to close at 10. I don't know of any state that did that.
Mosher adds that Dr. Harris often consulted with those in industry before she issued her orders.
The survival rate that we've had of our hospitality businesses has frankly stunned me. I mean, partially because the restrictions were fewer, our customers stayed loyal. And so the attrition rate that I've been seeing in other states happily wasn't reflected in Wyoming.
Chris Brown of the Wyoming Lodging and Restaurant Association says Harris was put in a very difficult situation and handled things well. He says she and the governor had their hand on the pulse of what was best for the public and the business sector. Brown says he's grateful for their approach. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck. The COVID-19 pandemic created a lot of changes for those in the food service industry, and when statewide health orders were rolled back in mid-March, businesses responded in different ways. Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Engel has the story.
When the pandemic hit the nation last year in March, the governor issued public health orders that required all food establishments to close to the public and only offer food to go or for delivery. These restrictions slowly started lifting until almost exactly a year later, when all public health orders for restaurants were lifted and businesses could return to their pre-pandemic operations if they so chose. It was met with a mixed response from both the public and business owners. Coal Creek Tap and both locations of Coal Creek Coffee in Laramie are operating at around 60% of capacity, and they're still requiring masks on employees and customers. Owner John Guerin says most people have been agreeable to the requirements, but they have seen some conflicts.
My bartenders from the brewery were telling me they got verbally assaulted last night by a person who just has had it. You know, they were yelling at him in front of, you know, 15 customers, and he's just standing there bug-eyed and just, you know, I hear those stories weekly anyway, not every day, but for sure it's happening all the time. And I get it. I know I'm sick of it too, but I don't know. I wish people would practice a little more self-control.
Guerin says they returned to half capacity in January, and after restrictions were lifted, added more tables. He says they kind of had to. The business saw drastic losses at the beginning of the pandemic.
I've been doing this, working in Coal Creek this is my 26th year, and I thought we just lost out everything. I mean, the numbers were so bad. They weren't 50%, they were 20%. And my staff went from, well, it dropped by 60%, people quitting.
Guerin says business has been steadily improving, but they're still slow. They plan to monitor infection and vaccination rates to determine when to safely make any more changes to their restrictions. But other places decided to return to normal as soon as state and local mandates were lifted, like Jeffrey's Bistro, also in Laramie. Chrissy Matthews is a co-owner of the business.
as owners, we kind of sat down and talked to each other and we said, you know what, we are going to follow what the state or the county says. And so when the county said we could do this, we started doing this. And when the county said we could do this, you know, so we really just followed along with what was required for us.
They're seating customers at full capacity and don't require masks on staff or customers anymore, though they do have some available for customers who want one. Matthew says their food is better suited for in-person dining than to-go, so they felt they needed to reopen.
As far as our guests go, really they haven't voiced much concern about lifting a mask mandate or even happiness, I guess, you know, that we've lifted it.
Jeffrey's does still offer food to go to accommodate patrons who aren't comfortable with their policies, and Matthews says they've been doing better than pre-pandemic to-go business. Some restaurants in the state took a hard stance against some health orders and found that they were rewarded for it. Like James Andrews, owner of the Red Zone Sports Bar and Grill in Powell. He gained statewide attention when he refused to follow health orders and close his business at 10 p.m.
I still have people come in every day and thank me for standing my ground and standing up for our First Amendment rights.
Andrews says he followed all other health orders when they were in place, but if he had followed the curfew, he wouldn't have made enough money to stay afloat.
Because I'm going to lose a third of my employees. And after 10 p.m. is when we make our money. That's when they make their money. So they're going to go somewhere else and make money.
As it was, Andrews lost a lot of his employees when the business tried to move to to-go only. The revenue didn't even pay for the software they purchased, so the business had to close for several weeks. As a result, many employees found jobs elsewhere.
Normally, I go through 11 or 12 employees a year. Went through 42 employees last year because everybody was making more money on COVID unemployment. And the only employees I could get were people who didn't qualify for unemployment for the last 2 years.
It doesn't matter how many restrictions food service locations have. All of them are dealing with a workforce shortage, especially in Laramie, where many are college students and still not on campus. And while vaccines are available to everyone in the state over the age of 16, many are still hesitant to fully return to normal and to public-facing jobs. It's been a year of just taking it one day at a time. And for many restaurant owners, that attitude will have to last for who knows how long. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Ivy Engel.
In a moment, we will explore the challenges of being a public health employee over the last year and discuss some of the issues college students have faced. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Carbon Valley. Finalists in the Carbon X Prize are facing an uphill battle.
I mean, the thing is we're coming into this $500,000 short. I would really love to see the X Prize come through with another $500,000 for us.
I'm Cooper McKim. Find Carbon Valley under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. The pandemic has brought the public health industry into the limelight. Public health officials and employees have been politicized, emotionally abused, and threatened by the public. And for an industry that's not used to this, employees are getting burned out. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska has more.
Before the pandemic hit, not many people knew each county had a public health officer and what they did. Natrona County Public Health Officer Dr. Mark Dowell has been in that position since the late 1990s.
I would oversee sexually transmitted disease clinics. I would do immigration physicals. We would look at reproductive planning, these kind of things.
But all of that changed when the pandemic hit. Public health employees all of a sudden were on the front line of the fight.
Endless phone calls, endless hours, endless types of stress, and huge policy-making decisions right on the fly. And having to do all the meeting with public officials, trying to convince people that the public health policies were the way to go for our county, having to be in the media a lot, and having my life threatened.
Now, local public health employees had to tell people what not to do in order to protect their health and those around them. But Park County Public Health Nurse Manager Bill Crampton says no one liked anything they had to say, and it came in a spectrum.
And that spectrum involves percentage of folks who feel there are rules and they need to be followed implicitly without question, and everybody needs to do everything they're told. And then the end spectrum are people that were just, and still are, just rampant. This is against my constitutional rights. You can't make us do these things. A very self-centered approach to the whole event. Trying to address all of those at once was very challenging.
Crampton says while making these decisions and educating people is a part of his job, receiving this level of abuse is not.
They made a point of sending very negative emails and making negative phone calls. And, you know, I got to the point where I wouldn't return voice messages. I'd listen to the message and that would be the end of it. I tried to be accessible, but there got to be a point where, for my own sanity, I just couldn't do it anymore. I just could not talk to some of these people because they were out of control. A lot of us felt threatened. We still feel threatened a little bit.
For the president of the Wyoming Psychological Association, Mark Holland, what public health employees are experiencing is similar to the iconic image of former President George W. Bush being told about the first World Trade Center being struck on 9/11.
You could read it on his face. He just went from a peacetime president working on whatever was a priority that morning to he's at war. And that emotional reaction is not unlike a similar emotional reaction that you've seen with our public health officials.
Holland says public health employees are trying to focus on the facts, but the fear and uncertainty have been driving the public's response and actions for more than a year. He says once the vaccines came out, it was a little easier for public health officials because now they had a solution. But until then, and even still, burnout is prevalent amongst these workers now, and that can have a pretty bad effect on human bodies.
It's hard on our stomachs. We develop ulcers. It's hard on our brains. It's hard on our bodies, and it's hard on our mental health because we're no longer balanced in our thinking.
Holland says relaxation is key. Natrona County Public Health Officer Dr. Mark Dowell agrees.
Thank God for exercise. Thank God for watching sports once in a while. And jazz music, and just finding places to go in my brain to decompress.
But it's still hard.
Some days I want to scream. Some days I just get angry. And some days I say, okay, you make in your bed, you're going to lay in it. But it affects my friends and my family too. So it's like emotionally, this is very difficult because I just think about a pandemic as everybody rallying together in a dangerous situation to get through it.
Dowell and Crampton hope that residents will make choices to protect each other going forward, like getting vaccinated. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
The pandemic impact on mental health has been felt by many, from adults to children. But for college students, that may include the entire reshaping of what they thought their college experience would be like. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler spoke with psychologist and assistant director of the University of Wyoming's Counseling Center, Julio Briones, about how students are faring during the pandemic.
Obviously, we moved to telehealth, which has created some unique opportunities and challenges. We're able to see more students from different places because they don't have to physically present to the university counseling center. So some of us have gotten licensed in other states. As far as clinical presentations, it's been a lot more anxiety, social anxiety, and depression as well.
Could you expand a little on that? What are you seeing in those cases of anxiety and depression?
I don't have exact numbers on this, but most classes are done remotely. So students don't really have to leave their living space a whole lot. They don't have to leave their rooms. They don't have to leave their dorms and can stay fairly isolated. So any natural kind of activity they would have to alleviate some social anxiety would remain. And so it would be, in some cases, easier. However, in the long run, it makes it harder, because when you don't challenge mental health distress, it can just grow, and which makes it more difficult later on. And thankfully, this semester, I think there has been a little bit more classes offered in person. However, I'm not sure of the exact numbers of that. I still think the majority of students are doing classes remotely by Zoom. So there still isn't a whole lot of opportunity to do things, you know, in person. And as far as depression goes, I mean, again, isolation's not great for depression. Isolation can make depression really hard to treat and really hard to improve, because there's less access to do things, less people to interact with, and it just makes it more difficult for everybody if there's not a whole lot of social contact to treat things like depression or anxiety.
Yeah, and I know everyone's situation is different and how they feel is so different, but how are you counseling students through this time?
I really try to do things that are within their scope of ability. I mean, so for example, if students need help creating a routine, creating a healthy routine is really important. Not forgetting that there are still options that they can do that are healthy. They can still go to Half Acre and work out there. When the weather is kind to us, they can still take walks and go running if they want. There's still things that they can do to impact change and be civically engaged, which is useful. Also to try to create study routine, study habits with peers or people in their pods is really useful too. So trying to create normalcy and chaos is what I've been trying to do. And it works out better some days than others. The night times are always really difficult for everybody because there can always be that 9 to 11 o'clock period of nothing really going on. And that's hard to manage if you don't have social support underneath your belt. So those are some things I've been trying to do, and trying to do things that are culturally appropriate for everybody. And everyone's a little bit different. Everyone can be a lot bit different. But trying to make sure that things are unique, interventions are unique for the students.
Yeah, and I guess moving forward, we don't really know what the long-term effects on mental health are going to be from this. And so how do you and the Counseling Center move forward into the next year to prepare for something that we don't really even fully understand yet?
Creatively. We look at research very frequently to see what outcomes are. People are studying COVID and its impact on people of all ages all the time. And so we look at research and what it says and how to apply that to our own student body, to our student community, and what interventions we can do from that place. And then we also need to be dynamic and responsive. And we also need to be realistic. We are an extremely small staff, and it does not take a lot for us to get overwhelmed personnel-wise. I want to say that there's 6 or 7 of us that are full-time, maybe. So we have a large influx of students like we expect in the fall. It's going to be challenging for us. So we're going to do our best to stay well and provide equitable and effective treatment to people best we can.
Julio Briones is a psychologist and the assistant director of the University of Wyoming's Counseling Center. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
All right, I appreciate it, and hope you have a great rest of the day.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces, and thanks to all of you who supported this program during the recent fund drive. You can still support our Wyoming News effort with your pledge online. When we come back, we will explore a couple of health issues, including what it was like to be a freshly minted mom during the pandemic. This is Open Spaces.
This time on The Modern West, our roundtable conversation about solutions to the problem of rural decline.
No, we're not going to wait. This is vital to us. So they make the effort. They collaborate. They get partners. They built it themselves.
Reversing ghost towning, a special bonus episode with rural advocates and thinkers from across the U.S. Find The Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Sponsored by Sheridan Travel and Tourism.
The This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The Kaiser Family Foundation released a report on sexual and reproductive health with a focus on how the pandemic may have changed things. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen spoke with Brittany Frederickson, a senior policy analyst for the foundation. She says one thing that really shifted was more women getting certain kinds of care from home.
We asked if people had had a telehealth visit prior to the pandemic, and very few had. If we're looking at the urban-rural differences, 14% in urban areas said they had, and 13% in rural. So there were really no differences there. But then during the pandemic, we asked between the period of March 1st and the survey was fielded in November, December of 2020, and 39% of women in urban areas had used telehealth at that point, and 32% in rural areas, so a few more in urban areas. So it's definitely increased.
I'm glad you mentioned rural women, because I wanted to ask about them. I mean, in what other ways did they respond in the survey, or, you know, how were they different than their urban counterparts?
So some of the things that were urban-rural differences, the number one reason for rural women was mental health services. 24% of women in rural areas said that they had had a mental health visit as their most recent telehealth visit, and 16% of women in urban areas. We found fewer women had accessed telehealth for sexual and reproductive health services. So those may be services that women are preferring to seek in person. And so I think that is the important thing moving forward, is ensuring that we have both of these options for women that may not have a safe place in their home to take a visit or have internet issues and would rather be a provider in person, that remains, you know, an option as well.
And I noticed that rural women were also the least likely to have a pap test in the last 2 years.
Yeah, so that was an interesting finding. And you know, that could be because there are just fewer reproductive health care providers in rural areas. And we know that this is an important screening. Women only need to have one every 3 years. But, you know, after 1 year being at home for an entire year, there goes a 1 year. And then just ensuring that you get in for your regular screenings. And at these, you know, well woman visits, they also do breast exams to identify any sort of risk for breast cancer. So I think we found in our survey that, you know, people are going without these preventive care services during the pandemic, especially women, and women in fair, that are reporting that they're already in fair and poor health. And that may be because they're worried about, you know, going into a clinic and being exposed to COVID. But in the end, if we delay these preventive health care services, we could result in a lot more long-term negative health outcomes.
You mentioned these breast exams as something that's not really your primary reason for getting in the door at your doctor's office, but, you know, still really important, which brings to mind these screenings for intimate partner violence and how important those are.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so many things are covered in a well woman visit, and a lot of counseling and education happens. And we found that a lot of women had discussed contraception with their provider, but yeah, very few had a provider ask them about STIs or HIV. And then around 38% said that they'd been asked about intimate partner violence. And this is a recommendation from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. So this is a pretty low percentage. And I mean, like we said on the panel, that could have been exacerbated by the pandemic as well, because women are taking these telehealth calls from their home. And if you're already living in a space that's not safe, it's a lot more difficult to disclose that you may be experiencing intimate partner violence. And I think the other thing is providers struggle with some of these screenings, these sensitive topics, because you have to have resources available if a woman discloses that she is experiencing intimate partner violence. And providers might not always have those resources on hand.
Right, which, you know, reminds me of another part of the survey. There were some questions regarding the interactions between providers and patients. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, we asked a couple of different questions. One question we was asked was around contraceptive counseling. And this was a scale that asked women 4 questions about their most recent contraceptive counseling experience with their provider. And it's basic things like, my provider respected me as a person. They let me say what mattered to me about my birth control. They took my preferences seriously. They gave me enough information to make the best decision about my birth control. And only 44% of women rated their provider as excellent on all 4 of those criteria or 4 items. And the percentage of Black and Hispanic women, that percentage was even lower. So that was one of the questions we asked about. And then one of the other questions, we asked women a number of negative experiences they had had with their provider. And women were much more likely to say that they had had an experience with a provider where their provider dismissed their concerns in the last couple of years. So, you know, I think just, you know, that patient-provider counseling and interaction is so incredibly important. And it affects whether women want to come back to see their provider as well.
Well, Dr. Fredrickson, thank you so much for your time today.
Okay. Thanks, Maggie.
Last year, we heard from a first-time expecting mother who'd be delivering her newborn during a pandemic, something Vanessa Haney never thought she'd be in. 1 year later, we checked back with Haney and some other new moms who shared the same experience. Wyoming Public Radio's Nina Rao has more.
Vanessa Haney was 7 months pregnant when I last talked to her in April of last year. 1 year later, I'm talking to her as she works from her home office as a new mom to a young son.
Yeah, lots of changes to kind of take in all at once.
Her son was due on July 7th last year, but arrived earlier on June 30th. And that unpredictability is typical in childbirth. But there were also more unexpected things that happened to Haney because of the pandemic.
Everyone's wearing a mask. I wouldn't recognize any of the doctors that I saw in person because I haven't seen their whole face. We weren't allowed any visitors. So my parents were actually in town, but not allowed at the hospital.
Her hospital visit was shorter too. Instead of staying for 3 or 4 days after delivery, Haney was only there for 1.
Once he was growing up,
Haney's talking about her son here.
When we were kind of starting to leave the house a little bit more, it was just so different because, I mean, there are so many fears associated with, you know, newborns and sort of exposing them to new people, and then sort of heightened and almost kind of, like post-traumatic stress from the pandemic, right? So now you're dealing with a newborn and then, you know, trying to go out in public and, you know, on top of the pandemic. So it was just a little bit more nerve-wracking, I think.
Another new mom, Kara Brummond, felt the same way, returning home after delivery.
The hardest part was coming back from the hospital. Everybody wants to visit your baby. Everyone wants to see it. And you're like, wait, we're in a pandemic.
Brummond gave birth to her daughter in September of 2020. And for the most part, her pregnancy during the pandemic was fine.
That was something that I think was a surprising benefit in the end, because I got to be working from home in a little bit more of maybe a relaxed environment as my pregnancy kind of built throughout 2020.
But there was one main thing that got her nervous.
They weren't offering any of the what to expect when you're expecting classes in person. So we had to just follow this online, and we weren't able to like practice positions or breathing patterns. We just learned this stuff on a video, had no real application of it.
The COVID-19 pandemic has actually shown that being socially connected in meaningful ways is actually key to human health and survival. So much research has been done outlining how social distancing negatively affects learning and growth, and it prevents people from effectively socializing, which is a fundamental human need. This isolation has been the biggest struggle for new mom Teddy Friedman.
I've been fortunate to have a group of women that I've connected with as a new mom. But, you know, if the pandemic were not a thing, I would have more regular social interaction with other moms and other, you know, more of my friends I'd be seeing on a regular basis.
Friedman delivered her daughter back in April of last year, around the beginning of lockdowns in the state. And the hardest part for her so far is not being able to walk down the street and show up at a friend's door and walk in the house, or invite friends over to share a meal and conversation about the funny things her daughter has been doing.
you know, we can mention that to friends, but it's not the same because we just don't have that regular interaction.
But the pandemic has also allowed Friedman and her husband to not think too far into the future and really try to be present for their daughter.
I think not having distractions of people, even though people are so wonderful and helpful in many ways to have by your side, I think just the focus we were able to give to our daughter helped us react in a really healthy and positive way.
While the pandemic has put uncertainty on the forefront of our daily lives, Friedman, along with both new moms, Vanessa Haney and Kara Brummond, are going to take in this new chapter of their life one day at a time. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Naina Rao.
You know, there was curiosity about how the pandemic might impact the housing market in Wyoming, whether folks would downsize or upgrade, whether there would be an influx of buyers or not. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim spoke with Lingle State Representative Shelley Duncan, who owns a real estate firm, to get a feeling for what actually unfolded.
So you have a lot of people who are relocating from, say, on their farm. They've decided that, okay, now's the time, the market's good, so rates are low, or they just had the right person come along and say, hey, you know, would you be interested in selling? We've had a lot of that happen. So we've had a lot of people for farm and ranch that they sell the farm and they move into town, downsizing. We also have, keep in mind, people during the pandemic were having to homeschool their kids. Well, if you normally have a job to go to and you normally have a school to go to and you have places to go, your 2 or 3 bedroom home isn't a big deal with 2 baths. But when you have a family of 5 or so and you're having to live under the same roof and have nowhere to go, that gets tight. And so then you have those people who maybe their job is secure and they're doing okay during the pandemic and they've been thinking about relocating or upgrading. We saw a transition where people are starting to move and they're wanting these specific places for office or specific place for school or things like that that we haven't seen in the past. So the pandemic has created a new buyer wish.
Do you have any idea where the biggest changes actually occurred within the state? If there was anywhere that was more popular than somewhere else?
Well, that I'm not for certain, but I can tell you everyone is experiencing 5, 10 plus offers within minutes of the property being listed on the market.
Okay, interesting. Was all this activity a surprise to you? Was there any thought that the pandemic might cool the housing market?
Oh, completely. Across the board, all of us were prepared that we would be considered non-essential and that we would have to close our doors. I participated in the PPP funds because I was expecting that my doors would be closed. We wouldn't be doing any sales. So none of us expected that we were going to have this increase in business. We thought everybody was just going to be shut down. So we were amazed and thrilled that we were able to stay in business.
You mentioned that any home is getting multiple offers. So for those who might be looking at buying a house now, what can they expect?
It's interesting. You're going to see less inventory for sure. We're just across the board have very limited inventory. So you're going to go in as a buyer and expect that you're going to have to compete. So first thing that they need to do is they need to make sure that they have everything ready and prepared prior to going in and looking. So that means go to the bank, make sure you're pre-qualified, make sure you know what you can, how high you can go, and what your limitations are. If you really want an advantage, you really need to work with a realtor because they're going to be the ones that have the insight of what's coming available and what's, you know, there. Otherwise, you're going to be spinning your wheels, frustrated because there's offers out there and you didn't even get to see it until it's already on the market and it's already under contract. So just be prepared, get all your financial documents and everything ready so that you're ready to make an offer as soon as you walk into a house you find. And be prepared to be aggressive. You're going to be disappointed in this market right now if you don't act quickly. The other thing is I would caution, is rents, as jobs increase and as more Fed money comes into the market, your rents are going to go up, is what I see the trend and hear from from economists is that rental rates are going to go up.
That was representative and broker owner Shelley Duncan talking to us about the pandemic's impacts on the Wyoming housing market 1 year since the pandemic began to hit Wyoming hard. Thank you so much for joining.
Great. Thanks.
When we come back, we'll find out how the pandemic impacted nonprofits and how COVID-19 changed some plans. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Human Nature, Sherman was an elephant researcher who needed a sign. Then she met a king.
It's like being looked at by a whale at that proximity. You know, you can't see the whole animal. You just see like this huge face and the eye.
Meeting a king. I'm Erin Jones. Find Human Nature under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Nonprofits are all over this state, in every industry. They can range from social services like homeless shelters to art and community centers. And when they can't provide services, communities feel the impacts. COVID-19 has highlighted exactly that. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler found out how some plan to move into the future.
The Council of Community Services in Gillette provides a lot of critical services. It focuses on homelessness and poverty, like running a food pantry and the city's only homeless shelter. The council's executive director, Michael Scott, says for years, the council's building has been falling apart.
The flooring of the shelter was so old that I honestly laid just a big, thick piece of plywood down under the washing machine because the flooring was like bowing into the basement.
So back in late 2019, when the city gave them $250,000 to cover some of the upgrades, they were excited. But then it was March 2020, and the COVID-19 pandemic was hitting the community and the people they serve hard. So they went ahead and allocated $50,000 of that money to be used to keep people in their homes.
Because, you know, that's the right thing to do, and it prevents a lot of trauma. And it would keep people out of our homeless shelter and in their homes.
Scott says they only used about $12,000 before federal aid finally came. And the council has continued to receive more, but Scott says it goes right out the door to programs and the people they serve. And during the pandemic, she says the community brought in tons of donations, from monetary to basic items like toilet paper and bottled water.
Before that, we didn't have that much people donating. You know, we've got great donors, but we didn't have what we had in this past year.
Nonprofits all over the state have been affected by the pandemic in different ways. While some, like the Council of Community Services, were seeing massive increases in need for some programs, others were forced to pause and adapt to entirely new ways of providing services. In Gillette, the Ava Community Arts Center couldn't hold classes or events, and people couldn't walk in off the street to see or buy art. But Ava director Quinn Goldhammer says their small staff got to stay in their office and figure out a way to still help, like making to-go kits for one of their youth art programs so classes could continue.
I think that really is our mission with Ava, is that we truly do believe the visual arts enrich lives, and I think there was never a time more relevant in my life than last year to bring that into the community in kind of whatever way we could.
But for Terry Watson, it was a different experience. Watson is the president of the National Outdoor Leadership School, or NOLS. It's based in Lander and runs outdoor education and leadership programs across the world. She says lockdowns all over caused them to shut down their programs. And then because of the business's size, they didn't qualify for any federal aid.
We laid off about 60% of our headquarters staff, about 85% of our programmatic staff, and 100% of our seasonal work agreement instructional staff. And that was really pretty devastating.
But they got to work reimagining how their programs could work. They're slowly recovering, starting up programs and hiring more people back, especially since how many people have been getting outdoors in the last year.
Pre-pandemic, we believed that our mission had value to the individuals who take our courses. But the pandemic spotlighted, you know, in great relief for us, that now more than ever, being able to go on a Knowles course or take a Knowles Wilderness Medicine course can be truly transformative and life-changing.
Now, all these nonprofits are looking to the future and wondering what's next. Watson says she's already seen more interest and businesses are expected to be able to pick right back up, but it's not that easy.
I think that it's going to be devastating to small companies, but I think as an industry and in terms of demand and need, that we're going to see a greater desire and a greater investment in people's time and attention in outdoor recreation and outdoor education. I mean, we're seeing it now.
Michael Scott with the Council of Community Services in Gillette says her employees have taken on bigger workloads because of the increase in need, but the aid and donations they receive can't go to salaries.
It's difficult, I'm sure, anywhere in Wyoming, and I know at least in Campbell County, to find people that will work positions because they're not, you know, hugely highly paid positions, and they are difficult, and there's a lot of burnout. So when you find good people that are good at their job and like what they do, you really don't want to lose them.
On top of that, Scott says she's worried about how an increase in need will pair with less government support.
I'm terrified that not only the city and the county might forget, but the whole community. You know, when it's on the news all the time and they're looking at long lines of, you know, people in Dallas lining up for a food pantry, they think, oh, I need to donate. But I worry that we'll go back to doing what we've been doing and doing more and getting less.
Scott says state and local cuts are already on the way. And while rules around the federal aid are strict, the council is able to make some improvements to their shelter with the CARES funding they did receive. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler.
Let's now talk about education. The idea was to get more students at St. Stephen's School interested in becoming fluent in learning Arapaho. Teachers had a plan, and then the pandemic hit. Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Stagner finds out more about a language immersion program that turned into virtual instruction to help save a dying language.
All right.
And look those, ye's a deep knocker sage. I ain't no Santa.
That's the sound of the Arapaho language being taught online. The St. Stephen's Indian School on the Wind River Reservation plans to build a language immersion program. The idea originally was to have a kindergarten class go through the program together to create a cohort, a group of kindergartners who would speak and learn Arapaho together. The classes would be held half in English and half in Arapaho. Well, that was the plan. Dr. Tim Rush is a retired professor at the University of Wyoming. Rush and the late Dr. Whiteplume had been working on an immersion program model for years. The model includes three teachers, one fluent speaker and cultural mentor, another teacher who is close to being fluent, and a novice Arapaho speaker.
The late Dr. Burnett Whiteplume and I developed this model. Well, this was 10 or 15 years ago. So the BIE, Bureau of Indian Education, liked what we proposed and they funded it.
The grant was around $200,000 to do research on how to best implement Dr. Rush and Whiteplume's immersion model. St. Stephen's teaches Arapaho for all grade levels, but part of the problem is that so few young people become fluent Arapaho speakers. While the language classes enforce the basics of the Arapaho language, there are less than 50 fluent speakers of the language alive today. Very few of them are younger than 30. And that's why they wanted to try this new immersion model. Then COVID-19 shut down schools, and St. Stephen's had to pivot how they were going to teach Arapaho through the immersion program.
At a meeting, we had a kind of an epiphany where we said, you know, we should be using a homeschool model, digitized virtual vehicle for engaging the kids.
Early in the pandemic, St. Stephen's handed out hotspots for households that had bad or no internet service to better help with online learning, and also bought laptops for students to make sure that they could access their classes from home. So why not utilize this to help facilitate the immersion program? And instead of three teachers, now anybody who is fluent can teach in the immersion program. Macy Mortimer is the distance learning coordinator at St. Stephen's. Mortimer says she's concerned that the students might lose something if the immersion program goes totally virtual.
And right now we have language classes at the school, K through 12, but our students just aren't becoming fluent. And that's kind of the missing piece, I think, to the puzzle. They're learning the language, but I think with the immersion program, we can just emphasize that instruction so much more and ensure that the students learn the language on a lot deeper level, which will only increase their cultural identity and help them succeed.
Mortimer is also a math teacher, and while she sees the need to go mostly virtual, she worries about how the students will retain the information they get in the new version of the immersion program.
That I just don't know if the learning is necessarily as deep and ingrained as when it is hands-on based, or like I'm saying, the traditional, you know, practicing the language and repeating the language.
A benefit to putting these lessons online is that they will be an archive for future generations to learn from. The grant from the Bureau of Indian Education allows the Arapahoe Immersion Team at St. Stephen's to digitize instructional manuscripts that the Northern Arapahoe Tribe is in possession of, manuscripts from the early 1900s. Frank Norunner is the superintendent of schools at St. Stephen's and was a co-writer of the grant the immersion program received. Norunner says he's especially excited about archiving the lessons.
Well, then they could go back to this archives, this treasure trove of all this indigenous methodologies and language that we archive for their people. So that's what I'm really excited about.
Norunner sees the language immersion program as a place to instill pride in the Arapaho language and culture. He says bringing the lessons virtual might not have been the first plan, but he thinks that making the lessons available to the whole family at home is an excellent way to preserve the language and to keep people safe for now.
And I think we owe it to our ancestors and our descendants to keep that cultural identity going, moving forward, and to save our languages.
The virtual immersion program is slated to start this fall with curriculum not just for kindergartners, but for all grade levels. For Wyoming Public Radio on the Wind River Indian Reservation, I'm Taylor Stackner.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. Archived editions of this show and individual segments can be found at wyomingpublicmedia.org and our station Facebook page. The show is also available via podcast at all the usual places. Anna Rader is our digital editor. We always like feedback about the show and ideas for future stories. Also, if you haven't yet, please support Wyoming Public Radio with your pledge of support again at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.